You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Over the past few weeks, there's been a sudden outbreak of seemingly random acts of violence by members of white supremacist and far-right factions of America. Those groups may have been quiet in recent years, but they are not new, and their history is a complex, often hidden aspect of American culture. Leonard Zeskind, a winner of a MacArthur Fellowship for his work on this movement, now has written a book on the subject called Blood and Politics, the History of the White Nationalist Movement from the Margins to the Mainstream. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Welcome to our show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Now, let me begin by pointing out that this is a huge book, over 540 pages of text, and it would be impossible to get into everything. But let's begin by defining terms. In your title, you call this movement white nationalism. Is that interchangeable with suprematism and separatism?
Well, what I argue in the book is that there was a white supremacist movement that formed after the defeat of the old Klan-style groups in the civil rights era. And this white supremacist movement was predicated on the notion of white dispossession, the dispossessed majority, if you will.
So that's different from the kind of anti-Semitism that we see from all the neo-Nazi groups.
Well, no, actually, the anti-Semitic conspiracy theories fit into that as the hidden hand behind the dispossession of white people. So this white supremacy movement existed for several decades, and then around 1990, with the collapse of the Soviet bloc, white nationalism emerged as a transformed version of the old white supremacy.
Now, does this all precede Hitler's rise to power in Germany? I mean, would we have been hearing similar things after the Civil War?
After the Civil War in the United States?
Because the Ku Klux Klan is obviously tied in with all of this, isn't it?
Well, there's a Ku Klux Klan today. It's much smaller than it was, certainly, in the 1950s era, the 1960s era, smaller still than it was in the 1920s.
And smaller still than it was in 1870s.
In the 1860s and the early 70s. The biggest era was the 1920s, when they had about 4 to 5 million members. But there's still a Klan today, but in the main, there are other types of organizations today.
No, all I meant was, is this something that goes back a long time in American history? Because you begin your book after World War II.
Well, the notion of white domination is a founding principle in the United States of America. And at different moments when that white domination was challenged, the Civil War, migration of black people into the industrial Midwest, Klans, white supremacist groups have emerged to defend the status quo. They emerged to preserve white supremacy. The movement today, however, believes that white supremacy has been overturned and they're seeking to return it.
Mm-hmm. They also they present themselves as patriotic groups, but they have different takes on some of our wars than you might expect.
Well, they're opposed to foreign intervention in the current period. That's where the collapse of the Soviet bloc falls in. People, for example, like Pat Buchanan during the Reagan era and up till 1990 was a fervid interventionist because he wanted to fight communism all over the world. Today, he's an isolationist, a nativist, and he works heavily with the white nationalist crowd.
Well, I was reading about James von Brunn, the Holocaust Museum shooter, apparently a World War II veteran. He was opposed to World War I because he agreed with Hitler that was a Jewish conspiracy to destroy Germany. He says very proudly that his family is of German-Austrian extraction, settled in St. Louis in the mid-19th century, wants to make some kind of a connection to what happened in Europe.
Absolutely. There's a wing of this movement that feels very connected to European developments. And in fact, Mr. von Braun was under the guidance, if you will, of people that he named in the acknowledgments of his book. He wrote about a 180-page book that's out there on the web. And in the acknowledgments, he names three people: Francis Parker Yockey, Wilmot Robertson, and Revelo Oliver, all of whom are major characters in my book. And you'll find out about the ideas that motivated von Braun by reading this book.
And those people are generally unknown to the public at large. A lot of the other names will be recognizable. People like Willis Carter, for example, and William Pierce. But I never heard of these people.
Well, that's why I wrote the book, is because these people and the organizations that they created are generally unknown to the larger public.
But you also talked about them as a wing. So we're talking about a number of different groups that have certain things in common but also disagree on some of the finer points?
Well, some of the larger points, actually. There's a mainstreaming wing of the movement that's actually, in the book I describe Willis Carto as the godfather of that movement. He cut the path for those parts of the movement that wanted to win a larger following among the mainstream of white Americans. And people like William Pierce, who was a former physics professor, who led the vanguardist wing and wanted to form small groups of very highly organized and educated cadres.
And he wrote the Turner Diaries, which inspired Timothy McVeigh, among others.
He also wrote a book called The Hunter, which was about a lone killer. And it's The Hunter that actually is in play right now.
Because these are people who are out righting the wrongs, in a way, of society.
Taking independent action.
How do they circulate their ideas? Before the internet, how did they get their ideas out?
They published, one of the groups published a tabloid that in the late 1970s had a weekly subscriber base of 300,000 nationally. They had, that publication continued on until the 1990s. They have their own mailing list, their own meetings, their own conferences, their own Bible camps, their own survivalist fests. And it's a mini movement. It's invisible to liberals.
Is there a segment of the population that doesn't self-identify as but would support a white nationalist leader?
Well, let's look at the Republican primaries in 1992 when the white nationalist movement was very much behind Pat Buchanan's run through the Republican primaries, and he won 3 million votes. Let's look at the Louisiana state elections in the late 1980s when David Duke, a former Klansman, a National Socialist, although he today runs an office in a New Orleans suburb, actually lives most of the time in Austria and works over in Europe extensively. David Duke ran two statewide campaigns in Louisiana and won a majority of the white vote statewide.
Now, why would he live in Austria? Is it because it's difficult for him to live here? I've also wondered why many white nationalist leaders portray themselves as American patriots but then identify with Northern Europe, especially with the Norse gods and things like that.
Well, their notion of American nationalism is an extension of Europe and the European whiteness. And so the multiracial aspect of the United States of America, they do not embrace.
My guest is Leonard Zeskind, whose book, Blood and Politics, The History of the White Nationalist Movement from the Margins to the Mainstream, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Where do women, what's the role women play in this movement?
Well, in the ideology of the white nationalist movement and its related movements, women take a back seat. They're supposed to follow men. not a traditional role unlike that assigned to them by the Christian right. However, at the local level, a lot of Klan dens were actually run by the Klan wives. They were the secretaries. They collected the dues and so forth. And there are women active in the movement. There's a section of the skinhead movement where women leaders exist. They're active in it. They're not gone.
Although the skinhead movement represents something of a generation gap, doesn't it? There's kind of like in the 60s, we talked about the old left and the new left. There's an old right and a new right, isn't there?
Well,
I'm not talking about the regular, the mainstream American right. I'm talking about this far, slightly
yes,
crazy.
Yes, there's a generation gap between certainly the 1950s era white supremacist and the 1970s era white supremacist like David Duke that came along on the one hand, and the late 1980s, early 1990s white power skinhead movement. To some extent, that generation gap now exists as a cultural gap.
Because the younger ones are listening to certain kind of music, for example, that older ones would be horrified by. They dress in ways that the older ones would be horrified by as well.
Yes, they're listening to metal music and not Wagner.
Well, what about all the symbols? That there seems to be an obsession with signs, symbols, and codes. Why is that? I know that was something that we also saw with the Nazis. Does this grow out of the same kind of thinking?
Well, I'm not sure, because there's parts of the movement that don't have the symbols and signs and so forth. The Nazi-esque wing certainly does. The main symbol they have is the badge that they wear, that they consider their skin color, the badge of their national identity. That's the major symbol for them.
You mentioned conspiracy theories. Pretty much all these groups, conspiracy theorists?
No. I think that there's a wing of them that consider themselves scientific racist, that look to genetic determinism to tell them that whites are superior and this should be a white Christian civilization. Conspiracy theories are a form of devil theory in this universe.
But they often blame the Jews, and they blame the Illuminati and the Masons and other groups like that.
The Masons have come and went as a conspiracy theory. The Illuminati is for very fringe.
Von Braun complains about the Illuminati.
It's for very fringe parts of the movement. Today, if you looked at the average white, Council of Conservative Citizens, which is the lineal descendant of the old White Citizens Council and is the largest of the organizations today, there's not a lot of talk about conspiracy theories, or certainly not about the Illuminati.
The Zog and all of that stuff?
Some discussion about how the Jews run the government. But for them, that's a conspiracy, but it's a fact of life, not a deep, dark secret.
My guest is Leonard Zeskind, who has written on racism and anti-Semitism for publications like the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the American Prospect, The Nation, Rolling Stone, and The Forward. And he's written a book now called Blood and Politics, The History of the White Nationalist Movement from the Margins to the Mainstream. It is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Leonard Zeskind, Z-E-S-K-I-N-D. His book, Blood and Politics, The History of the White Nationalist Movement from the Margins to the Mainstream, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. What do the nationalists want for the future of the United States?
They want whites-only space. They don't want to go back to Jim Crow. They don't want to go back to the old ways. They want to recreate a partition, either take white domination over the entire country or partition off a piece that is theirs for whites only.
Certain states would become whites-only states?
And it depends on who you talk to in the movement. There's a variety of plans. they're hoping to, and there's another smaller group that thinks if they just repeal the 1964 civil rights laws, they can get what they want.
When they talk about whites only, Jews are whites, aren't they?
For some, a very small segment of this movement. But for the most part, in their pantheon of whiteness, Jews aren't part of the white race.
What role does religion play in this white nationalist movement?
There are a variety of religions in this movement.
Because the only one I've heard of is Christian Identity, which was created, I guess, out of the Aryan Nations movement, Richard Butler, or did I get that wrong?
No, the Christian Identity, and actually I wrote a monograph for this that was published by the National Council of Churches in 1986 that was the first to describe the theological structure of it, is a descendant of a phenomenon, a 19th century phenomenon known as British Israelism, and was brought into the 20th century by Wesley Swift after World War II, a Klansman from California. And the Christian Identity phenomenon is predicated on the belief that white people from Northern Europe, here we have a tie back to Europe, are the actual people Israel, that Jews are satanic and imposters.
How do they explain that? In other words, the Garden of Eden was in Sweden?
The Garden of Eden is where the snake bit the Adam and Eve. The snake, the snake is Satan, and Eve produced the Jews as devil people. Mm-hmm. And they believe that black people and people of color are pre-Adamic. And they have a convoluted series of archaeological findings.
So did they have their own Bibles?
No, they read the same Christian Bible that the rest of the Christians read.
And you said that Christian Identity was one of many.
There's other, as you mentioned earlier, there's the groups of this movement that are infatuated with Odinism and the symbols of the Norse gods. I think that's more cultural than theological.
And what is the one-seed, two-seed theory? And
that's a division among the Christian Identity crowd. It's a very arcane piece of the work, but you have to understand it in order to understand Christian Identity, and it's where they place the origin of the satanic character of the Jews.
And then there's Odinism, you said?
Odinism, that's the Norse gods. Mm-hmm. Like I said, that's less theological and more cultural.
Well, okay, so we have all of this stuff. It sounds kind of crazy to most people in America. And I saw obscene political cartoons where the people who believe in this sort of thing are stupid. You suggest that they're really not stupid, that there are an awful lot of very well-educated professionals who go along with all of this, or even in the leadership.
The white nationalist movement as a whole looks very much like a demographic slice of white America. It has a lot of blue-collar and working-class people. It's mostly middle class, and the substantial part of the leadership is professional middle-class people with college degrees. There's a high number of attorneys in the leadership, and there are a lot of people with PhDs behind their names who subscribe to these ideas.
You begin your book with Willis Carto and William Pierce and end it not long after their deaths. Is the American white
nationalist... Carto lived on.
Excuse me?
Carto's still alive.
He's still alive.
I mean, Carto's still alive. Pierce died.
But is the American white nationalist movement bound up with these men?
Absolutely not. There's a reconfiguration process going on as we speak. We saw it in these latest shootings. But we're also seeing it with white nationalists who were preparing to participate in the Tea Party phenomenon on July 4th.
And one of them is calling you right now, I think. I should have told you to turn
off
your cell
phone. Turn off my
phone.
Yeah, they do. Sorry.
It's okay. How has the election of Barack Obama, what role has that played in all of this?
Well,
has it exacerbated things?
I'd say it's a complex phenomenon because the piece about the government, they've long believed that the government is in under the control of their racial enemies long before Barack Obama came along. But the piece that bothers him about Barack Obama is the large percentage of white people, over 40%, that voted for him. And that is the stumbling block for them.
Some of the other issues that pop up again and again are Holocaust denial, but also abortion and homosexuality, which strike me as not inherently threats to white power. So why do some white supremacists oppose them so strenuously?
It's part of their theological, the Christian identity theological structure, which shares significant numbers of ideas with the Christian right.
Now, all of this has gotten a lot of people very defensive. The other day, a guest on the from the Ayn Rand Institute argued to Fox News' Glenn Beck that because von Braun is a racist, he must, of course, be a phenomenon of the left. And Glenn Beck didn't disagree, and then he wondered, how did it happen that you look at people that are Nazis and you say that those are right-wing? It doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
Well...
And then Rush Limbaugh also declared that von Braun has more in common with the marches and protesters we see at left-wing rallies.
Well, I think it's not uncommon for conservative spokesmen to want to pin everything they don't like on the left. And so this is something that the American people obviously has a sense of revulsion at. And so they're going to make it left-wing. It's also true that there's a whole segment to these characters who have tried to prove that National Socialism, which is Nazism, is some form of socialism.
Because it has the word socialist in its name.
Absolutely. It's nutty. That part of it's nutty.
My guest is Leonard Zeskind. His book, Blood and Politics, The History of the White Nationalist Movement from the Margins to the Mainstream, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. One of our listeners, Gabrielle in Brooklyn, left a comment on our show page. She said, we in the U.S. often say that firebrand imams incite the mosque-goers to acts of terrorism. Can my guest be kind enough to discuss the state of right-wing media, especially cable networks such as Fox Today, and the effect that it is having on the mobilizing of these domestic terrorists to violence?
Well, I do not discuss the radio and TV phenomenon in that way in the book. And I have to point out that white nationalists don't like the Limbaugh types, and they don't like the Sean Hannity types, because on questions like support for Israel, they are what they call kosher conservatives. And there's a lot of time spent in this movement bashing so-called kosher conservatives.
Because they hate Israel, the state of Israel?
Oh, of course they hate Jews, so they hate the state of Israel.
But what about the whole business of the rapture?
And they're not rapture people. They're not fundamentalist Christians. They don't think they're going to leave. They think they're going to stay and fight. Mm-hmm. And understanding that kind of kingdom theology is central to understanding them. I will say this. Some people in the movement find justifications in some of the anti-immigrant rhetoric that you're going to hear on the talk shows.
They do have their own talk shows and their own websites and their own publications.
And their own media. So they have methods of reaching out to others and communicating internally. It's a social movement, a normative social movement.
What was the importance of Ruby Ridge and Waco for both the movement and the American government?
Well, I would argue to you that Ruby Ridge and Waco combined form part of the triumvirate of events that launched the militia movement.
The militia movement was a new development, or did it grow out of other things? There was the Posse Comitatus, wasn't
it? It was a recreation of Posse Comitatus-style ideas in the Christian common law courts and in the militia. But it took those events to precipitate a larger movement phenomenon.
And so they that convinced them that the government was out to kill them all. What was their reaction to Timothy McVeigh and the Oklahoma City bombing?
They tried to prove for a long time that the Oklahoma City bombing was really a government agency operation that went amok.
The same sort of thing that people are doing with 9/11, the World Trade Center, was all created by Jews and or the Mossad or the American government or any number of other
people.
Anybody
but them. Sort of like what you just heard with the radio guys who say, well, somebody else did this.
Now, your subtitle is The White Nationalist Movement from the Margins to the Mainstream. Haven't they always been mainstream in some parts of this country?
Well, what they have done is they have established a firmer hold in the mainstream. The old white supremacists, the notion of supporting the old Jim Crow status quo, still has appeal among folks. But we're talking about something different. We're talking about a revolutionary movement that wants to overturn the status quo, not preserve it, and that movement has found its way into the mainstream.
And what proportions of the public are we talking about? Barack Obama was elected with strong white support.
Well, I think it is, at this point, a small movement. They're primarily mobilized in the anti-immigrant movement. And when you look at the anti-immigrant movement, they're holding up the discussion of immigration, comprehensive immigration reform. And in the Congress, while the congressman might not be part of this white nationalist movement, there's 90 members of the anti-immigrant caucus in the House of Representatives. I would argue to you that that caucus exists because there's mainstream support for the ideas of a white Christian country without Spanish-speaking brown people.
I've looked at James von Brunn's website, and among other things, he says, millions of low IQ non-whites are encouraged to illegally invade the USA. They are provided sanctuary, jobs, health care, schooling by those intent upon destroying Western civilization. Whereas the subject of this, well, and then he goes on to defend somebody, a Finn who has been had been thrown out of the country, a good white guy. This is the sort of rhetoric we're hearing from other people, or is von Braun that bad apple, that the crazy kook that some people are describing him as?
That's standard rhetoric, whether it's in the Minuteman organizations or in the small armed groups or in the anti-immigrant caucus.
Alvin in Manhattan has posted this question. Was the American eugenics movement a way for the intellectual and leadership classes to express its racism and other prejudices?
At the time, at the turn of the 19th century, in the early 1900s, the scientific racism, which included the eugenics phenomenon, held the commanding heights of American academic life. If you went to Harvard and the Ivy League schools, they were teaching it as a matter of social science. And it was a way of apologizing for the supremacy of the Anglo-Saxon population over the rest of the people and as a way of keeping everybody else in their place.
So is this the movement today just simply the legacy of all of that discussion in the past?
Absolutely and absolutely not at the same time. This is a movement not seeking to preserve, but it's seeking to overturn.
Because they feel that they've been defeated by some kind of conspiracy or by stupid people.
By the civil rights battles of the 1960s, which dispossessed the white majority.
So what do you see the future? Do you see it in the younger people, the skinheads, or is it still going to be this older, perhaps more respectable-looking group?
I think that there's generations that are going to carry this problem further into the future. In the mid-century, this country is going to undergo a very significant racial transformation where white people who now have the prerogatives of majority status are going to become one minority among all, among a nation of minorities. They're going to have to learn to share with other people and not have it all. And that is going to precipitate, in my mind, a greater move towards white enclave nationalism.
Because the current situation with a black president just is going to polarize some people?
I think it has polarized some people, but I think...
Well, wouldn't they already have been...
Yeah, the battles are yet to come.
And do you see this as being more the sort of thing that we're seeing? Obviously, you can't predict, but Von Braun isn't the only person out there, or the killer of Tiller. They're not the only people out there who are willing to assassinate people they disagree with.
Absolutely. Over the weekend, there was an incident in Arizona where members of an anti-immigrant organization broke into a house and killed an adult male Latino and his 9-year-old son, and as part of their campaign on the border. So this business goes on, and it will go on. I think that immigration is an ongoing issue because of the demographic character of things.
Leonard Zeskind's book is called Blood and Politics, The History of the White Nationalist Movement from the Margins to the Mainstream. It is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.